Thank you.
Well, good morning. I don't quite know how long I've got to do the cut sign. I'll try and curtail things. Quite a lot of things to get through this morning. And I seem to be introducing a new book as well, which happened last time, which I thought Bruce finished off our talk on 1 Thessalonians last week very well. I've decided that it's much easier to start than it is to finish, so I'm not unhappy to be speaking again. I hope you're encouraged by 1 Thessalonians. You'll need to carry that encouragement from 1 Thessalonians through into Amos, because that passage, which I asked Joel to read out in full, does actually rather set the tone for the whole of Amos. It's pretty grim for the full 9 chapters, I'm afraid. The sad truth is, of course, that the message of Amos is as relevant today as it was then. Human nature hasn't changed in 2,800 years. Okay, we are starting a new series. Let's try and lay some foundations for the speakers in following weeks. So I will have a bit of a historical background, a bit of an overview of Amos, and we'll just go through a few points in the chapter that's been read to us. But I'm really going to try and make this very practical as well. And I should also just say, I know this has been studied in 2 home groups recently. I was in the Redland home group, so if some of the ideas or thoughts from that home group crop up there, I make no apologies for that. It's borrowing with pride, I think the expression is. It's a collective effort. Okay, so if I could have the first map, Al. Amos, the man. You can follow this on the map above. Hopefully you can read that at the back. So the businessman who became a prophet. Most businessmen, of course, go into business to make a profit, not to become a prophet. I don't know if that was a deliberate pun in the title, but I just thought I'd get that out of the way at the start so that at least you knew I'd spotted it. It's a bit of a weak pun. Okay, we read in verse 1 that he was one of the shepherds of Tekoa. Tekoa apparently was a hilltop town about 10 miles south of Jerusalem. Obviously quite good sheep farming country. Apparently the Hebrew word that's used for shepherd in that place means a kind of breeder or a master of sheep. So you need to think more like Abraham or Job rather than, say, the humble shepherds that we read about in the Christmas story. Or if you want to update that, you can perhaps think about the archers, which you're probably missing at the moment on Radio 4. We also know that he owned a fig orchard and that he came from Judah. Okay, the date and the setting of Amos is pretty precisely dated as 760 BC. Because he mentions this earthquake, for which there is some archaeological evidence. And that was right in the centre of the reign of 2 kings, Jeroboam II of Israel and King Uzziah of Judah. You can read about those their reigns in 2 Kings 14 and 15. And as has been noted, actually, in the green notice sheet, it was a time of prosperity for both kingdoms, rather surprisingly, particularly for Israel, the northern kingdom. And this was partly because Assyria, which was the great power, was going through a period of weakness. They had dominated Syria, or Aram, to the north, which I think is just off the map there. Yep. Because Assyria had sort of was weak and preoccupied elsewhere, Israel was allowed to expand again and actually reconquered quite a lot of territory from Syria. So there was quite a lot of trade and commerce going on, particularly between Judah and Israel, which means that Amos probably travelled, if he was a sort of businessman farmer, probably travelled between the two quite easily. And Samaria had become the capital of Israel, and it was quite a kind of commercial centre. So, and there was also a tendency to move towards a kind of urban lifestyle. The cities were sort of growing up, and the agriculture was perhaps being put on one side. And the consequence of this, of course, is that in these ancient times, the poor particularly depended upon agriculture, upon the land. So we have a picture here of the rich getting richer in their cities, the poor being deprived of the land and the availability there. And it's into that context that Amos is speaking. If we just turn over a couple of pages to chapter 7, if you're following in Bibles, and down to verse 12 of chapter 7. We'll just read a few details about Amos's actual ministry, because there's a brief bit of sort of narrative here. So Amaziah was the priest of Jeroboam, the king's priest, and he says to Amos in this, this brief little bit of biography, "Get out, you seer, go back to the land of Judah, earn your bread there and do your prophesying there. Don't prophesy anymore at Bethel," that's on the map a few miles north of Jerusalem, "because this is the king's sanctuary and the temple of the kingdom." Amos answered Amaziah, "I was neither a prophet nor a prophet's son, but I was a shepherd, and I also took care of sycamore fig trees. But the Lord took me from tending the flock and said to me, 'Go and prophesy to my people Israel.'" And then he goes on with his prophecy. So we've got a few biographical details there. And you can see that Amos, he goes to a foreign country. I don't want to make too much of this analogy, because I don't want to disrespect the Welsh, but it's a bit like crossing from Bristol to South Wales. It's only about that distance on the map. And it's a similar kind of feeling. It's the same country, but it's a different country, if you like. Amos was clearly a man of deep conviction and very devout. He was also very brave to go to a foreign society, and to criticise their society, their religion, and their government, and to say, this is all rotten to the core, especially at a time of, apparently, of economic prosperity. He was simply a messenger who delivered God's message and did what was asked of him. Okay, so that's the ministry. Let's just briefly have a quick breakdown on the book as it goes through. It's a series of oracles which were given at Bethel. And the main themes, as has already been noted, are sort of social justice and false religion. So in chapter 1, we have this judgment on the surrounding nations. Chapter 2, we have the kind of opening statement against Israel in rather more detail. It's almost like a legal statement or accusation. Chapters 3 to 6, there are five oracles detailing charges of social injustice, false religion, and what God's judgment is going to be. And chapters 7 to 9... we have five visions indicating that this judgment is going to be unlike previous ones. There will be no escape. The destruction will be complete. And then right at the end of chapter 9, but don't race ahead and look at them, there are about five verses of comfort, which are worth waiting for. So, anyway, you can see that the book is carefully arranged. It was probably written over a period of 1 to 2 years, or that's the period that Amos was prophesying for. Very good use of illustrations, rhetoric, and poetry. So this was clearly a cultured man. He wasn't a sort of country bumpkin, basically. Okay, let's look at a little more detail at chapter 1 before we sort of try and move on to some practical implications. So chapter 1 is judgment on Israel's neighbours, and each oracle that was given against them, it's very formulaic, isn't it? For three sins of, then he mentions the city or the country, even for four, I will not turn back my wrath. It's a common formula in Hebrew poetry. It occurs in Proverbs and Jobs as well. The point he's making is there's lots of things wrong with your society, and then the emphasis is on the last point. And it is worth just briefly looking at the kind of geographical pattern, because it does actually make a particular point. So he starts with Israel's relatively small neighbours, starts with Syria or Aram up in the northeast. He moves down to the Philistine cities down in the southwest, you can see on the map, back to the northwest to Tyre and the Phoenician cities, down to the southeast, Edom. So he's kind of triangulated around Israel, and then obviously Ammon in the east and Moab in the southeast. And the audience probably quite enjoyed that, thinking, yes, actually all these countries, they're in the wrong, they're doing these things wrong. They were probably expecting him to turn his attention to Assyria and to Egypt, the sort of big, relatively big superpowers of the day. But in fact, he turns around onto Judah, and then, of course, onto Israel. And, of course, the point of this is it draws them in. So you think, yes, actually these countries are in the wrong, but actually basically what he's doing is inviting them to condemn themselves. But they don't realise it until he's worked through the rhetorical balance. And that judgment did come on Israel only 40 years later. If I can have the second map, please, Al. You'll see that Assyria did actually sweep through the whole of the region and completely wiped out Israel and deported the people. And in 2 Kings 17, the verse says explicitly that this punishment was an exile was for the sins against God. And you can see also that Jerusalem was besieged around about 700 BC, and Judah became effectively a vassal state of Assyria, although it did last a bit longer. Just turning back briefly to the accusations which are made against these nations in chapter 1, they're all, well, it has been noted, except for Judah and Israel, they're all accusations of treachery. Slave trading, breaking international treaties, not observing the conventions of warfare, and desecration of the dead. Something probably more important in the ancient world than it is now. And I must admit, I thought, well, these things aren't terribly relevant to the modern world these days, are they? But perhaps only a casual inspection or thinking about it suggests, yes, we don't formally have slavery these days in many countries, or hardly any countries, but there's quite a lot of what is effectively economic slavery, economic oppression. The West seems to be quite happy with trade agreements until the economic climate gets worse, and then suddenly they start to look rather one-sided, particularly as far as African trade is concerned. And we've had plenty of examples recently of the really rather casual killing of non-combatants in warfare. So perhaps these things are rather more relevant than we might at first give them credit. Okay, that's the historical background, and also hopefully brings us up to date. I'm going to put Amos aside for a moment and try and apply the principles, because obviously that's what matters, to our own situation. But you may feel like these are very big issues. It's difficult to influence the government. And I'm going to try and stick quite closely to the brief I was given for this sermon, and like last time, in terms of how we influence the government and what we can do about it. But I'm going to try and make it practical at the kind of grassroots level, so achievable action in politics and civil life. I'm not going to touch upon the issues of social justice and fair trade so much, because I think these come more out of the following chapters, so I'll leave that for following speakers. But the first thing I want to say is just put a challenge or a question to you. What's the largest block of voters in the local elections in Bristol this year? Or actually, what was the largest block of voters in South Gloucestershire or Somerset? Or in fact, any of the local elections this year? Any suggestions? People who didn't vote. Exactly. Yes, thank you very much. The people who didn't vote. And of course, that's similar across the nationwide elections as well. I must say, I do feel very strongly the first thing we can do is we can vote in the elections that we have. God hasn't told us how to organise our civic society and our political affairs in the same way as he hasn't told us how to organise our churches. Although I do think actually the model that Alma uses is pretty similar to the biblical principles that were given. And it has to be admitted that Western democracies are pretty imperfect. They've got the responsiveness of the proverbial oil tanker, whatever that is. It's about 3 miles to stop and 5 miles to turn round. So they don't respond very quickly, but they do respond eventually to changes in public opinion and to the accumulation of votes. You might call me naive or even optimistic. I have to say, my children would say if I'm the most optimistic person here this morning, then the world really is in trouble. But I think if all the Christians in Bristol voted, our councillors would be around here a lot more. I mean, I'm sure they are interested to speak in churches, they do. But if everybody who didn't vote, who was a Christian who did vote, that would add quite a block to the votes cast, and that would make a difference. Now, I'm not advocating voting for any particular political party. That would be inappropriate. And some of you will probably say that all political parties are as bad as each other. But one thing's for certain, the situation isn't going to correct itself if we don't take part in the process. And also, people in other countries are still fighting for the right to vote or to have meaningful elections. And I think we hold them in contempt if we don't use the votes that we have. Some people will claim that they can't vote for any particular party or that they need a none-of-the-above option. Well, you can always vote for a minor party to register a sort of protest vote. Quite often there is a Christian candidate, particularly at national elections, if you wanted to vote for a Christian particularly, or there may well be a fair trade type candidate. There were quite a few of those, for example, in the European elections. But even if you don't want to vote for a minor party, there is something else you can do, which is to spoil your ballot paper. It's not illegal, as far as I know, to actually do that, and you can also write a protest on it. If everybody who could vote turned up and spoiled their ballot paper, and the politicians could see the stack of votes on the table, which would be, for local elections, about 60% of the entire vote, compared against the smaller proportions for each party, the politicians, I think, would take note. Because they would know then that there are people out there who are prepared to vote, who basically their message isn't getting through to. If you don't vote, you can afford to be ignored, basically. Bristol City Council is no longer hung on the basis of one quite tightly contested ward in Southmead, where only 40 votes made the difference. There are usually in national elections constituencies where less than that number of votes will make a difference to some of the awards. There will be an election next year, if there's not one this year, and there will be some boundary changes in Bristol as well. So at least one seat will become quite marginal. I know there's at least one Christian candidate standing who goes to one of the other churches in Bristol. Whether you vote for one party or whether you vote for the individual doesn't really matter. I think we should be familiar with the issues, we should be familiar with the candidates. It's important to vote, and we should actually use that because it will affect policy and decision-making eventually. You can, of course, try and influence the government directly by writing letters, emailing, or signing petitions. I think letters are still quite good, actually. You usually get a response from doing that. Again, you're unlikely to change policy, but what you do is you inform public opinion. You let people know how you feel about it. So my son David actually wrote to David Blunkett when he was six, I think, to complain about Literacy Hour. Okay, it's perhaps not a matter of social justice, although some of the children might feel it is. And he did get a couple of replies, and I think, you know, policy on Literacy Hour has changed. I'm sure not as a result of his letter, but, you know, it helps to, as I say, inform public opinion. If you do write, I think quite a good thing to do is, especially if you write to your MP, write to the other candidates in the constituency. If you're writing to a government minister, also send a letter to the opposition, shadow opposition minister, the unofficial opposition, and any other people who are interested. If you write one letter, you can make it work several times. What else can you do? Well, you can write to the EU. I have to say, I've written to the EU a number of times and never had any single response. Probably not time to go into that. If you write to an MP or someone in the UK government, you will get a response of some sort. Of course, you can do something more active. You could join a political party, and that way you will get a Christian voice into that policy level at a local level, or maybe even a constituency level. You could consider standing as a councillor. I'm trying to persuade my wife to do that at the moment. That's not going to be very appropriate or possible for many of us, but it will be. But it is possible for some people, and maybe there are some people here who ought to think about that. And I'd particularly like to challenge the ladies here as well this morning. It seems to me that politics in this country couldn't possibly be any worse if there were more women involved in it. I think we could take the risk on the experiment of having a few more women in politics, and perhaps that is also something to think about. Of course, maybe something else to do is, rather than joining a political party, is to join a pressure group or a charity or a development agency. There are plenty of law-abiding, concerned groups trying to influence government policy directly, particularly in international and sort of global affairs. I can't remember the details, but I know Peter was advertising something on the Alma Mail this week, so there are local things going on. It's difficult to influence government policy, especially on issues of justice, because they're usually contentious, they're usually costly, and they're usually complicated by ideology. But if we don't vote and we don't express an opinion, then we can be safely ignored. And I think as Christians, we also have a responsibility to God as well to vote and to express an opinion, because if we don't, really it's the equivalent of passing by on the other side and doing nothing. Other people you can try and influence, and I think it's quite good, is actually the media, because they do both reflect public opinion and form public opinion. So the BBC, the televisions, the newspapers, politicians do listen to them. You know, call them to account when they get it wrong, when their programming is cheap or shabby, and praise them when they do it right. I've written a few letters to thank people for good programming or whatever, and you get really positive answers back from them. And the reason is it helps them to make the case for making better programmes which deal with issues more fully, more balanced programming. Otherwise, they just default to what's easy and cheap. Okay, my time is nearly gone. Let's move quickly on to international affairs. Well, it's difficult to influence our government. It's going to be very difficult to influence our government to influence other governments, if you see what I mean. And perhaps the example of Zimbabwe springs particularly to mind. What can we do at a grassroots level? Well, we've already had a very good plug this morning from Joel regarding BISC, which fits in very nicely with what I next wanted to say. We have students coming from foreign countries. These people are going to be the privileged elite when they go back to their countries. They're going to be in positions of power and influence, undue influence. So it's good if we can befriend them, if we can show them a positive example of Christianity, if we can let them know that not everybody in this country feels the same way about things, if we can set a good example. And what better way of doing that than supporting the activities of BISC and such things? We can help to support development agencies and charities, both prayerfully and financially. Your money goes a lot further in developing countries, so you can make it work for you. And you could even perhaps go and work for one short term. You could sponsor a child. I expect some people do that. That's a very good thing, very big thing to do. You can make a big difference to one person. I was going to give you an illustration of something that crops up in quite a lot of sermons and books, so apologies if you've heard it before, but it's about a story about a man who's walking along the beach one morning after a heavy storm, and all these starfish have been thrown onto the beach. And they're all stranded there, and there's hundreds, thousands of them. And the tide is going out, the sun's coming up, and obviously the seagulls are coming round. And as this man walks along, he picks one up and throws it back in. And he walks along, picks another one and throws it back in. And someone sees him and comes up to him and says, "What are you doing? You can't possibly make a difference to the thousands of starfish stranded on this beach." He says, "You're right, I can't make a difference to the thousands, but I made a big difference to that one I just threw back." And that's the thing. So something like sponsoring a child, you make a big difference to one child and to one family. And we shouldn't neglect also supporting our own missionaries in the places where they are, in foreign countries as well, where they can have some influence. I've just been reminded by Sarah, who came up and was given a box of chocolates, I think it was. She's gone out now. Something my wife did a couple of years ago for the teachers at the end of term for our children. She actually bought some of those presents, you know, where you can either buy a bicycle or a goat or a cow or something like that. And she did that for a couple of the teachers, my children's teachers. The teachers were so pleased after, they were both quite interested in perhaps international development and such like, but they were so pleased not to get another box of chocolates, another bag of smelling salts. You know, if you're going to buy presents for teachers, then why not do something like that? They really appreciated that. I mean, Sarah's obviously isn't qualified yet, so keep on giving her chocolate. But she will get bored of it in the smelling salts. Okay, I'm going to wrap up now. We seem to have come a long way from Amos, but the principles of social justice and fair trade still apply. So what are we trying to achieve here? Just three word pictures from Jesus's short parables of salt, light, and yeast. Salt to preserve what is good, light to expose what is hidden and needs to be brought out into the open, and yeast to kind of work through the whole mixture and to influence things. C.S. Lewis said, or reckoned, that it took only 10% of Christians to transform a society. Sadly, I think we're rather below that level at present, which may account for the state of things. Amos's situation was much, much worse, but that didn't stop him from answering God's call to speak the unpleasant truth. I've tried to give you lots of achievable, small, practical suggestions. I'm sure there could be more, and perhaps we ought to form a running list over the next few weeks, because I'm sure there'll be many more coming out of the rest of the series. But perhaps you're feeling a bit like the man on the beach with the starfish, overwhelmed by the size of the task. Yes, it's easy to say that God is bigger than the problem, but God isn't always that visible, is he? And I don't want to discourage you or burden you this morning. Above my desk, I've got a quote from Theodore Roosevelt, President of the United States at the turn of the 20th century. I don't know where I picked it up from, but I think it's quite good. He said, "Do what you can with what you have where you are." If that's good advice for American presidents, I'm sure that's good advice for us with our busy lives. The things I've suggested, I'm certainly not suggesting that you try and do everything, or even the things, other things that may be done. Do what you can do easily. If you want to accept a challenge from this morning's sermon, do one thing. Either start doing something you don't do, or do something else that you already do, which is built into your life, and do it more so. If you try and work on the things which are already within your life and add to them, that will be much easier to manage, because the accumulation of our votes and our small actions will make a difference if we're going to function like salt, light and yeast. We can call our government and the media to account. We can encourage them and influence them to do what's right. And when they do, we should also support them to carry it through and to finish it off. Thank you.